Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, Reptile Radio fans, and welcome to the July 19th, 2015 episode of your favorite Double R Eargasm Reptile Radio. We got another great show in queue for you guys and gals today as Stephen Tillis returns for a part two of a part one that made me want to have him on for a part two just because part one got such great reviews and so many listens. So before we get into that, I noticed a lot of new green memberships lately on the BLBC boards, and I want to personally thank you all for dropping a little coin to help support Mr. Suttle's efforts to keep the Bush League Breeders Club rocking with your contributions. Much appreciated. And for all of those that may not know, the green membership upgrade does come with some perks, so feel free to check it out on the BLBC boards, maybe hit Larry with a PM, and maybe sign up and get your own green membership. One more personal indulgence, and we'll get right to the show. I want to wish a happy birthday to my little 1996 girl, as she turns 19 this coming week. It may have been a lifetime for you, my baby, but it was an eye blink for me. Here's to a happy birthday, and to hoping that at least a couple of more of those eye blinks happen before you get to change my diapers. God knows I love you like nobody's business, my little girl. Our guest today does not need an introduction, specifically because I gave him one only last week. So here he is again, the kid from Florida with the intercontinental legs, Mr. Stephen Tillis. What's up, man?
Hey, CK. How you doing?
I'm good, man. How are you?
doing well.
Awesome. Now, listen, we're not going to have any phone drop-offs this week, okay? But if we do, do the same thing you did last week. Just call right back in. I'll jump you right back on the line, all right?
Yep, no problem.
Sounds like a plan. So now, I kind of sold this show as a Blood Python show because we haven't done one in a long time. And when I spoke to you last week, I just had a feeling you would be a great guest for that. So I want to definitely talk about Bloods. And I also want to talk about something me and you touched on a little bit was that you've been spending some time in the Everglades lately. And I'm sure that's something, too, that also gets people juiced up to, you know, get like that field herp experience, and it's kind of segues in good with what happened last week on the show. I thought that was great. So why don't we talk about the Bloods first, and you know, I'm guessing, I mean, is the Blood Python season kind of similar to the Bull Python breeding season as far as like you're probably right in the middle of it right now, huh?
Yes and no. It actually tends to run a little bit earlier than some of the Ball Python season. You know, I'm pretty much done hatching out most of the Bloods I'm going to hatch out this year. I think I have a couple of clutches still left to hatch out. But, you know, usually it's over. You know, the last stuff we'd hatch out would be like in August, would be the latest. And most of the stuff is, you know, July. So this is really the big hatching time, whereas Ball Pythons, at least in my experience, you know, that wave doesn't hit until like August to September.
Yeah, there's definitely some girls that are still ovving and laying based on what I've seen on the board. So that's not bad, though, a couple of months ahead of that, and it kind of spreads it out with you, because, I mean, you also breed BPs, so I guess that's kind of a good thing, not getting slammed at once with everything. Now, I know you've been into Bloods for a long time. I mean, look, I used to have a couple of Bloods, and both of my girls were sweethearts, man. I hear some stories about people how, you know, they're so aggressive and whatnot, and I'm sure some folks have had like a aggressive experiences with Bloods because they do have that kind of nomer, you know, that people think that they're nasty. But now, what are your thoughts on this, and what are your personal experiences on this?
So, really, when you get people with mean Blood Pythons, there's really only generally a couple of problems that they're experiencing. The first is that it's either a wild-caught or captive-hatched animal, you know, that's not been bred several generations in captivity. Most of the captive-bred stuff, that I wouldn't even call it aggressiveness. I would call it nervousness. It gets bred out pretty quickly. But I will even say that I've gotten in wild-caught adults, and for the first 6 months, they might be, you know, aggressive to work with. But once they kind of figure out that you're not going to eat them or skin them or anything weird like that, you know, they calm down just the same. The other problem people have with them, a lot of people keep their Blood Pythons too hot. And, I mean, imagine if you were sitting in a room that was 95 degrees all day, you know, you wouldn't be too pleased about it either, and so a lot of times they can be pretty uppity as well. And then the last problem that I think a lot of people have is that they start off with a baby, which is generally what I recommend, but, you know, they start off with a baby and they are too nervous handling it, and so they never really work with it, and then, you know, it never really settles down for them. What I've found in my experience is that blood pythons, you know, for the first year or so, they might be really nervous, but, you know, when you're the size of, I don't know, you know, a tennis ball
curled
up. A baby
blood.
Yeah, everything is going to try to take a go at you, so it's no wonder that you're nervous. But once they hit around 1,000 grams, I noticed that they really calm down pretty quickly. The problem is, if you don't work with them up until that point, they're not going to calm down really for you. And the other problem I see people have is that when they get nervous with the animal, they grab it behind the head. And if you grab a blood behind the head, you've essentially lost, I hesitate to use the word trust because I really don't want to anthropomorphize too much, but, you know, you do lose sort of trust with the animal. You know, going back to the wild caught adults that I've had, you know, like I said, for 6 months, they're really difficult to work with. And then as long as you can avoid not grabbing them behind the head and not rough handling them, you know, even they will settle down. So it's just a matter of kind of understanding the animal and not being too rough with it and waiting for the animal to kind of feel more secure, you know, instead of necessarily like forcing yourself onto the animal kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. A couple of things that you said make a lot of sense. One, temperature definitely makes a lot of sense. It's a proven fact that things get, including human beings, get more aggressive the higher the temperature, you know, to a point, unless you're at the point where you're melting to death, and then you just basically, you know, that negates that. But it's a fact. And, I mean, if especially I would think like a poikilothermic animal, like a snake, is going to get more aggressive at higher temperatures. I believe even, I'm sure tropical fish probably get more aggressive at higher temperatures too, you know? So,
oh, yeah.
And that sounds
sure.
like a, yeah, that sounds like a perfectly normal defense mechanism when, you know, it would be a defense mechanism when something, you know, is instinctually certain that other predators are going to become more aggressive at higher temperatures, right? So, like, if you were an animal in the wild and you knew that this was an actual thing, you know, this temperature-related aggression, you would have to up your aggression, you know, on purpose or not. You know, like, again, not to anthropomorphize it, but on purpose or not, everything would be more aggressive, and it kind of keeps things in balance that way. So you would defend yourself harder, you know. So I think that really does hit the nail on the head. And that makes a lot of sense because people do think that these things come from sweltering, you know,
yeah,
equatorial areas.
They definitely do not. I mean, they come from tropical areas, but as far as keeping them, especially compared to other pythons, they do not like it hot. And I should add, too, as far as tameness is concerned, my adult animals, I don't have a single animal where I don't feel completely confident that I can, you know, reach in there and pick it up without being nailed. You know, negating a feeding response kind of thing. So I would say a mean blood python, as long as you know, even have kind of half of a clue kind of what you're doing as far as handling them and working with them, you know, they can really settle down without too many problems.
Sure, I totally agree. And you were alluding to also the confidence transmits confidence. So, like, if you're confident handling it, the animal is definitely going to, the skittishness goes away pretty quick. And, like, you have any recommendations for people who, you know, let's say somebody picked up a blood and then they're like, wow, you know what, maybe I shouldn't have got this, I'm not really confident handling it. Like, how does somebody get over that? You got any suggestions?
Well, for the first, like, year or so, I would honestly try to keep handling to a relative minimum. I don't think you're going to make much progress. Once the animal hits between, like, you know, 500 and 1,000 grams, that's really the prime time to start working with the animal and handling it. But, you know, the biggest thing with bloods is to keep them supported. A lot of times they have kind of like a shorter fuse, it seems. Like a lot of the animals will be perfectly fine, and then it gets to a certain point where there's like, you know what, I've had enough. So I would say just don't push the animal past that point, and you'll know it when you hit it. But besides that, you know, it's just a matter of, yeah, it's just a matter of, you know, working with the animal. And, you know, a lot of times, you know, like a thick pair of gloves might help as far as if you're not feeling too confident holding a snake or avoiding getting bit. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's really not a big deal. And it really doesn't happen that often. I mean, I've been bitten by an adult blood, like, I can count maybe on one hand the number of times that's happened, and usually they're all feeding response bites for me screwing up. As far as juvenile bites, you know, it happens, but as soon as you've worked with the animal for a little bit, you get really good at reading their body language, and you know, they'll tell you when enough is enough.
Yeah, that's the key, man. And, you know, we've harped on that on the show before. You study your animals, learn your charges, and understand what they're telling you, because they generally tell you before they act. You know, it's pretty normal that you're going to get some kind of indication that something's going to, like, Rosie Bowes kind of shake their head a little bit before they give you a tag. I noticed that, which, you know, I bred Rosies for years. I noticed that, sand boas will, like, kind of push their nose into you before they lay it on you. And again, it's not a huge bite, you know. But, right, you've experienced that, right, where they dig in a little. So they're a little.
With the blood pythons, what they'll do is when they're kind of getting ticked off, they'll, do this really slow tongue flick, and they actually leave the tongue, like, kind of sticking out of their mouths for, you know, a couple of seconds longer than you would think they would normally do. And that's when you know that, you know, this animal's really not feeling it. It's not having it anymore.
Well, that's a great little tip, and that's why you guys out there listen to Reptile Radio, because that's not something that you're going to just automatically know unless you listen to the show. I mean, that's a great piece of advice, man, and I know if you've seen it multiple enough times for it to register with you that it's a fact. You know, I mean, I'm willing to accept that that's a fact. If you've seen it on multiple times before, you know, the animal lashes out, it makes sense. So they almost every species has their own little thing, and, you know, you just got to look for it and feel it and understand it, and you can avoid getting tagged. And better yet, like, when the handler gets tagged, that's a stressful incident for the animal. So now you've just imprinted on that animal that, okay, I was under a lot of stress, I struck, and he put me down, and I cooled off, and everything was fine. So now you've just trained that animal that if it strikes at you, that's a good thing for the animal, because now you're going to leave it alone. So I do like the idea of definitely handling it with gloves if you're not comfortable. You know, a decent pair of leather gloves or even gardening gloves are good, cotton gloves, kind of anything that kind of gives it something besides your skin to grab helps. And even, like, just put on a lightweight denim jacket if you're worried about getting tagged on your arms, you know. It's something that you can do to allow you to get the animal to the point where it's more comfortable. I love that stuff. That's good advice, man, and that was good to hear. Now, is it pretty much, I mean, most pythons are like 60-day eggs at, you know, high 80s temperature, but give us a quick run through, because I haven't had a BP show on, the other BPs, haven't had a blood python show on in a while. And I, you know, just run that through for the listeners who are not really as familiar.
As far as, like, the breeding process in general or just incubation?
Yeah, just like what you would do, cycle them and, you know, get them through to a hatching baby.
All right, so blood pythons, I feel, are honestly pretty easy to breed. I will say that you can't stretch them as thin or push them as hard as you can with ball pythons. You know, there's really an 18-month-old male blood python breeding would be quite a stretch. It happens, but it's not something you can rely on. So usually for age, I like at least 2 to 3 years, probably about 5 to 10 pounds on a male. For females, I like 3 to 4 years and at least 12 pounds, but 15 is looking a little bit better as far as, like, almost guaranteeing that she's going to go for you. I don't like to stretch my males more than, like, one male to two females. As far as cycling goes, I really don't do anything. I keep my room. I use ambient temperatures without a hotspot. So I keep the whole room between 82 and 84 the entire year. And I don't change that no matter what's going on outside. The only thing that changes in my room is ambient light levels. And so that's really enough to get them breeding. As far as what I've seen, so
that using
October,
natural light.
Breeding. Yeah. I basically just—it's literally just a window. Yeah. So as long as, you know, they really pick up on that, and that seems to be really what gets them going for me. And I start breeding in October. I expect eggs probably between February and March. Sometimes a little bit later, and then, like I said, stuff starts hatching out into May, June through August would be the absolute latest. So. And it's about 60-day incubation at about 88 degrees is what I shoot for.
Okay. Yeah, that's cool, man. Now, you know what? That's pretty soon. It's almost identical to bull pythons as far as this would be a real simple segue to go from a bull python keeper to go into to get into some bloods.
Yeah, I would say so. They do require a bit more of a keeper that's, you know, kind of in tune with their animals to some extent, but it's definitely not a stretch, you know, as far as husbandry or anything like that. Especially the only thing, a lot of people who are into ball pythons that get into bloods, they make, you know, a handful of critical mistakes, and one of those is keeping them too hot, as we talked about earlier. So, like I said, my animals will never see a temperature hotter than 84 degrees. You know, at 82 degrees, the heater shuts off. At 84 degrees, the air conditioner kicks on, and they don't have access to a hot spot. So that range is really what I shoot for, and they don't need anything hotter than that. So a lot of times, you know, a lot of people want to stick them in the same rack as they maybe even have their ball pythons in with, you know, a 95-degree hot spot or something really hot like that, and they don't need that. They don't do well in it.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I don't advocate 95-degree hot spots at all for I can't even think of a species where I would advocate that kind of hot spot.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it just doesn't make sense to me. I keep my hots, I have like a double heat tape on the back of my big rack, and the hot one that's all the way in the back is at 89, and the one that's in front of it is at like 85, just in case the back one goes off. There's like an emergency kind of heat tape in front of it, you know, but the one in front of it never really kicks on because the 89 one keeps it from going on. So it's like a fail safe. Yeah, it's more like a fail safe than anything else. But it's funny you mention that because when you think about it, okay, and I'm referring to bull pythons here because a lot of people in our audience are bull python fans. And if you're not letting that mom get over 84 degrees any time during the time she's ovulating and, you know, holding that clutch before she lays it, I'm wondering why you would think you need 88 degrees for the incubation process. Think about that.
That's a good question. I can't answer it with blood pythons because I've never done maternal incubation on them, but I can answer that with green trees because I have done it on them. And so all my snakes, ball pythons, white lips, berms, retics, you name it, I have tons of different pythons, but they all are kept in that same building, kept the same way, including the green trees. And so the green trees, when they've laid a clutch of eggs, I have stuck a probe inside the clutch of eggs, and it's 88 to 89 degrees inside that coil, even though the mom never experiences temperatures greater than 84 at the max. So I challenge the traditional view of ectothermic, where the snake is never hotter than the temperature that it's exposed to. I think there is some level of heat generation under certain circumstances and in certain, certain instances. So I think that, and I haven't done it, but I probably should, is that if I put a probe inside of a female blood that was incubating a clutch of eggs, even though she was never exposed to anything warmer than 84 degrees, I would be shocked if that inside the coils it isn't, 87 to 88 degrees.
Well, I mean, bloods are known to be able to thermogenerate by, by muscular contractions, aren't they? They're not like bulls. People have said that bull pythons cannot do that. Is that the same for bloods? Or, I mean, I know berms can do it. I mean, there are definitely animals that do that. So I know it happens in the genus python. But is this something that you would expect from a blood to be able to do?
I mean, I don't have the data to back it up. And, again, that's probably something I should get in the future. For ball pythons and for blood pythons, but I would not be, like I said, I would very much expect that out of them. I have seen them shiver. They are very good at covering up the nest. I just haven't actually stuck a thermometer or, temperature gauge in there just because I never really, had a need to.
Well, that's going to be one little project I want you to try next year so that we can report back on it. I mean, if you've seen them shivering, that's the activity that creates the rise in temperature, and it makes sense. I mean, lactic acid is produced, and it kind of raises the metabolic rate, I guess, because your body's got to get rid of the lactic acid, and since they can't sweat, their body must warm up, until that's processed out of their body, So it kind of makes sense to me. But, you know, I wonder why, you know, there's a lot of data that says that ball pythons don't do that. And I actually have a girl maternally incubating now that I'm trying to not bother her too much. So I haven't really been peeking at her more than once a week just to change her water bowl. But I haven't seen her shivering or doing anything like that, nor am I expecting to, because from everything I've read that, you know, they don't do that. But, you know, I'm doing my first maternal incubation, and it's definitely interesting to watch. Part of me doesn't want to watch it too much because I don't want to disturb the girl, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't want to make it more stressful for her, but it's cool. You should definitely do that, man, at least like for a week or so, just to maybe do your own, you know, get some research, man. Find that out.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I would not be surprised if ball pythons were doing, you know, something of that same sort. I know I've heard that in the past, that they don't really generate heat, but again, you know, if you have an animal burning energy, it's going to generate heat, you know, regardless. That's why, you know, if you feed a snake a big meal and you go and you temp gun that big lump in it, it's warmer than the other part of the snake. And that's not, you know, that's not an accident kind of thing. You know, I think there's more going on in these animals than we necessarily give them credit for.
Yeah, I'm totally down with that. And I encourage everybody to go out and do their own research. I'm doing a little bit this year because, you know, I basically only have one girl at my facility this year that was slated to go. I had two of them that I bred, and one of them I realized right away wasn't going to go. She was just a little on the, not young, but a little on the small side, and she just didn't take it right away, you could tell. And then this other girl, who's the only one I really wanted to go, and she laid her eggs, and I thought I had it all squared away because you know, I was going to let her maternally incubate. I didn't even fire up my incubator this year. So I was totally fine with that. And I had the temp set at 89 on the rack as normal. She lays her clutch, and then there's 5 eggs outside of her coil. And on like day 2, I realized, you know what? She's not going to collect these eggs. So I collected the eggs, and I started a thread on this, guys. If you want to check it out, it's on the BLBC board. So I did, you know, detail it because I wanted to write it down somewhere so I can, you know, refer to it later, and so everybody else could too. And I put the eggs on the topmost slot, which is about 6.5-7 feet off the ground here in the snake room, and I basically put them on a piece of egg crate in a damp tub. And I put the egg crate over where the hot spot in the rack would be, you know. So the eggs are sitting on top of the heat tape on an egg crate in a damp tub. So it's plenty humid in there. I have tops on my tubs in my rack, so there's humidity on the face of every tub right now. No problem at all. And then like a day or two into it, I said to myself, you know, it's kind of weird. I'm just wondering what the actual air temperature is in there, because just because the heat tape is at 89 doesn't mean the air temperature is 89, you know. So, son of a gun, man, I set up an adjacent tub with a thermostat in it, and I was scared to death because it was like 80 degrees. And I go, uh-oh, this might be a problem. So I immediately jacked the rack up 1 degree. I mean, I don't do anything crazy. I never, like, you know, overreact and, you know, jack it 10 degrees because I want, you know, that doesn't make sense to me, you know, to shock these things like that. So I moved it up to 90, and right now this is the first time my heat tape has been at 90 in probably, I don't know, 6 years. And I put a couple of pieces of foam in front to create like a bathtub, you know, temperature bathtub in there. Mm-hmm. Where the foam would keep that heat trapped at least up to the top of the tub, you know. And right now I'm looking up there, it's 83.5, so, and it's a warm part of the day here in the northeast, and it's 90 degrees outside, so it's kind of expected. But yeah, I'm going to be incubating this clutch half with the mom and half without the mom in the low 80s, you know, according to what it says on the on that adjacent tub. So it's going to be interesting to see if there's a big difference between the speed of hatch rate, you know, than between the mom's clutch. I'm guessing the mom is going to go faster, you know, than the loose egg.
Yeah.
So that'll be kind of a cool thing.
You might run into the problem too. I know we keep track of this at Eugene's, where, you know, the females, when they kick eggs outside of the coils, a lot of times those eggs, you know, it doesn't really matter what they do to them. Sometimes they're just not good eggs, you know. And I don't know how the females know that they're not good eggs, but a lot of times, you know, if they kick them out, we mark them. And a lot of times if eggs go bad, it seems to be a statistically higher chance that it's going to be the eggs that they kicked out, which is interesting. I don't know how they know it. I wonder if it smells different to them, but, you know, it's almost to the point where, you know, I don't think it's just an illusory correlation kind of thing. You know, I think they know what's going on in the egg sort of before it even starts happening.
That's interesting. Now, it is 5 eggs out of, and I can't tell what she's sitting on because I never pulled her off. So, but, you know, she's approximately 3,000 gram girl. So she's big enough to coil 8 to 10 eggs. She's had 8 and 9 egg clutches in the past where one egg out of the clutch has always not gone full term, at least, you know, so, but not, you know, not half the clutch. So I'm kind of hoping that's not the case. And when I'll find out, it's easy to tell which one she wasn't sitting on.
Yeah.
Because they're in a separate tub. So that'll be interesting, too. You know, I'm going to keep that in mind. And you know, I've heard that, you know, some hearsay about that, but I mean, I know Eugene keeps extremely accurate records. So I would take that for, you know, what it's worth. From him, but I'm gonna let you know, man. I'm sure I'll post up on the boards. I'm gonna keep track of this whole shebang and keep everybody up to speed. And I'm also looking actually for people who aren't on the BLBC boards. If you do have experience incubating ball python eggs in the low 80s, I would love for you to just tell me what happened. Go in that thread, post up, and tell me what happened with your experience, because I think this is something we should also pursue. As a group, you know, we're always looking for the best way to do it, and everybody kind of settled on 88 degrees, a great temp. But lately, I mean, my past couple of years, I had my incubator set at 87, and I have, you know, really good results with that. So I'm thinking, it hasn't hurt them yet, and drifting down. I mean, there is anecdotal evidence around that, you know, drifting lower than that isn't a problem. It just extends the incubation period. So
yeah,
curious.
I mean, well, seeing how they manually incubate eggs in Africa. And ball pythons are tough. They really are.
Yeah, I mean, you got a lot of real firsthand experience. And you know, and look, equatorial animals aren't subject to the whims of the, you know, the air temperature too. That's another thing. I mean, if you dig a hole 3 feet down in the earth, pretty much anywhere on the earth, it's going to be about 55, 60 degrees. You know, so like these animals can choose where they, what level of temperature they want to be at, almost like they're setting their air conditioner, you know, so, you know, because they're fossorial. So, you know, an animal like that that's not terrestrial or arboreal, that's going to actually have the opportunity to get in the ground, is going to be able to choose a microclimate of its choice. You know, you didn't by any chance temp gun the inside of any of those termite mounds or anything at any point, did you?
You know, I think we did. I don't know if I remember what it was off the top of my head. I'd have to go back and look. I'm sure I have a video of it I need to go back and look at, but I seem to remember doing that. I don't know. I didn't do
okay.
It a lot. I think I did it like once or twice, but I'll have to double check that.
Yeah, definitely, man. Post up any data you have on the boards. It's just great information for everybody to share, and you still owe us some pictures and vids, man, so.
Yeah, no, I'm getting there. It's been a busy week, so.
Is that a goat baying in the background?
Yeah, no, I have like about half a dozen goats.
This is a truly wild show, man. I'm totally stoked. All right, so that's cool. Now, you know, when I was a kid, half a hundred years ago, there was one blood python. It was Python Curtis.
Yeah.
Now, since then, they've subspeciated it. Even though they're not subspecies, they're distinct species. Now, do you, from your experience, I mean, do you have distinctly different, I mean, you know what species you have? Like, what species of bloods do you carry?
Okay, so I keep all three species of, which are, you know, Python bronchismi, which are red bloods, Python curtis, which are the black Sumatran short-tailed pythons. A lot of people call them black bloods. And Python, I think it's Frankenstein is how you pronounce it, which are the Borneo short-tailed pythons.
Okay.
I keep all three. And I will say that there is a distinct difference between all three. I feel like if I had solid white specimens of each of the three types, I would be able to visually tell them apart just based off of the characteristics and body shape and scale count. But so there definitely is a difference. It definitely is detectable, especially if you've kept all three. Yeah, so there is a difference, and they are full species, which I think that is you know, definitely valid to elevate them all to full species status. But you know, a lot of people get confused think they're either all the same species or subspecies, but at this point they are three distinct species that are very much different from each other.
Cool. And behavior-wise, too, you believe?
Behavior-wise, they're all kind of a relative blank slate as far as, you know, they can be what you make of them. As a whole, I've noticed that the Sumatran short-tailed pythons, you know, the black ones tend to be a little bit easier going right out of the gate. That being said, all three, I think, are perfectly adaptable to whatever you're going to make out of them, you know, as far as they're a reflection of what you put into them.
Okay, that's cool, man. Now, I know you work with a lot of different morphs. Have you ever considered, or have you ever considered any hybridization?
Okay, so I do have a pair of hybrids. I have a pair that were T-negative albino red blood pythons crossed with Python Curtis, the black Sumatra short-tailed pythons. And they look really cool. They're like a really white and yellow-looking albino. I call them my abominationable snowmen. and they're just a pet to me. They're actually some of my favorite bloods. Like, whenever I walk into the room, if I just want to play with a snake, you know, I'll 9 times out of 10 gravitate towards them. That being said, you know, it's not something that I have any interest in breeding commercially. It's not something I want to propagate because there is, I mean, first and foremost, you know, there's a lot of negativity surrounding them. So it's, you know, it'd be bad for business,
right,
to be a part of that. But at the same time, you know, it's also just not, a lot of this stuff isn't always represented in the way that it should be represented because a lot of times you have people that don't fully understand the differences between all three. And then, you know, even if it's not malicious, a lot of times they're representing animals in ways that aren't accurate, which, you know, is something that I want to avoid, so.
Oh, that's good to know. So I'm not expecting that you're going to be producing any bull python, blood python crosses or anything like that.
No, I almost think the more different species you get, the more it becomes okay. The problem is a lot of the blood pythons, even though they are very different from each other, blood and short-tailed pythons, even though they're very different from each other, they're similar enough where hybrids between them, usually you can tell it's a hybrid, but the more you outcross it, the harder and harder it becomes, to the point where you don't really know what you have. Whereas, you know, with a bull python, if you cross that with a blood python, I feel like, you know, it'd be pretty obvious that what you have is not a blood python or a ball python, but if you cross, you know, a red blood python to the black short-tailed pythons after, you know, one or two outcrosses, now you don't know if it's just sort of like a brown-looking red blood python or what's going on with it. So,
gotcha.
You know, it's almost like the more different it is, the more okay it is kind of thing.
Okay. No, that actually makes a lot of sense. It's not something you're looking to do anyway, probably, I'm guessing.
No, it's not. I mean, the hybrids are so cool to me for several reasons. You know, first and foremost, we as you know, a scientific community don't really have a definition of a species that holds true in every circumstance. So I like hybrids in the sense that they really challenge people to come up with their own species concept, and that's sort of what a species is. It's a human construct. It's a concept. And so, you know, the good thing about hybrids is they really do challenge people to really kind of think about what a species is to them, because, you know, if we see some arbitrary amount of divergence, like, you know, if you're 4.9% different, you're the same species, but if you're 5% different, now you've crossed some threshold and you're a different species, or is it, you know, obviously anymore, it's not, the species of a the old definition of a species used to be animals that can't interbreed with each other, and that's obviously not the case, because we crank out hybrids in a lot of cases, so... You know, that it really does challenge people to come up with what a species is to them, because that really is the definition of a species. I mean, I think last time I checked, there was like 23 different definitions of a species, and none of them hold true for every single organism on the planet. So it's sort of a unique window into viewing what's going on from a biological standpoint to determine why are these different? What does make these different? What makes these full species? So I have that, you know, scientific part of me that always likes to ask questions and always likes to you know, break through walls, even if it isn't the most the easiest going kind of way. But you know, it does challenge you.
No, that's our level of delineation is determined by us, and it might not be what actually is, and it's it makes a lot of sense. I like that you look at it that way. You know, I mean, these cross genus hybrids are the ones that boggle the mind for us, based on what we're taught growing up. You know, like, how could this possibly be? How can you cross a corn with a king snake? They're not even the same genus. You know, and that stuff like that is what really makes it interesting, and I could see how that would be a real challenge for somebody who's, you know, had to cut their teeth on this whole process before, and now it's basically out the window. You know,
yeah,
I like that.
You know, I think it's very, it's a very defendable standpoint to be totally against any hybrid. You know, I definitely think that's definitely a valid standpoint, but I've always been one to ask, you know, just, it's okay to be against it, but just make sure you know why you're against it, you know? And if it's because everyone else says it's bad too, you know, I don't really know if that's a valid enough reason. You gotta answer these questions for yourself, you know?
Oh, that's great, man. And you know what? You're a smart kid, and I'm sorry if I don't mean that in a derogatory sense. I mean, you're a young guy, and you you definitely have your own thoughts. It's not derogatory by any stretch. Now, listen, man, you've been stromping around in the Everglades lately, okay? And I'm sure everybody on the planet that listens to my show, okay, because we are planet-wide, by the way, wants to know what it's got to be an incredible feeling to be, you know, hiking around and then stumble on a berm in the glades. How does that feel? Like, what, like, as a herp enthusiast, like, does your heart pump when that happens?
So to kind of set the stage a little bit, herping in the Everglades is not kind of what it's cracked up to be. You know, the Everglades National Park, which a lot of people don't get to herp in because they protect all wildlife, which includes Burmese pythons, which is something that I have sort of a problem with. But anyway, so the national park itself, as far as herping in there, we did vehicle road cruising, which there's one road. There's one road. And you're basically just cruising back and forth, you know, all night. So in that sense, it can be really boring. There's really not a lot to see. But then it makes it just such a cool feeling when you see this big snake kind of stretched across the road, and there's no other, you know, there's other snakes in the Everglades too that you'll see a lot of, but there's nothing that, like, you know, fills the road kind of like a Burmese python does. Like, so there's the white lines down the side of the road, and you just see this giant thing covering these lines, and it just, you know, your heart kind of skips a beat a little bit, which is really kind of a cool thing. You know, not that it's cool that they're there, but it's very kind of surreal to see them.
Yeah, I can imagine that would be. And I mean, look, the Tamiami Trail is one lane in both directions. I know there's a couple of spots where it's two lanes wide, right, for people to pass and everything, isn't there?
Yeah, Tamiami Trail, which is north of Everglades National Park, is I think it's just two lanes with some passing lanes, I guess. But I drove down there last year. We saw a fair bit of stuff, but as far as the actual Everglades National Park itself, it's literally a 40-mile road from the entrance to the farthest point in the park, and there's nothing on it. It's literally just a road through the swamp.
That's awesome. Yeah, I've been down there a couple of times. I took my kids down there when they were little, and, you know, we got shots of them holding alligators and whatnot, and it's, man, that's just such a great, great place to go, you know, especially as a herp, you know. I mean, it's just so amazing. It's the second biggest national park in the country, I believe, right? So it's big.
Oh, it's huge,
you know,
yeah.
It's tremendous. And it's mostly swamps, so you can't really walk the whole thing. But, man, that's a really cool place. Now, you've been down there. Like, what's your official take on the invasive berm population there?
So a lot of people in the herp community kind of want to underplay the problem. And I definitely have been guilty of that in the past. You know, the snakes are innocent kind of thing. How can they really do that much damage? But I have to admit, going down there, they're definitely doing damage. There definitely is a problem. That being said, you know, there's a lot of other problems facing the Everglades too, from hydrology to invasive plants. The problem with that, and it goes both ways, is that Burmese pythons sell papers, which on the one hand kind of works against the hobbyist, you know, the hobbyist's favor. But on the other hand, a lot of times what you have to do in conservation is to get funding for stuff that isn't as cool, you have to kind of use cooler stuff. And we see this all the time from, you know, if you really want to save a habitat, a lot of times you put the face of something that's going to sell papers on it, like, you know, like a panda. You know, if your goal is to save the habitat, but it helps if you have this cute, fluffy animal that everyone wants to save. And so for the pythons, it's like we have this really important ecosystem that's facing a lot of problems. Even though the pythons may or may not, I personally don't feel like they are the biggest problem facing the Everglades, but if it draws attention to the Everglades, for better or for worse, you know, it, from a conservation standpoint, they're going to utilize that to you know, kind of create interest in the problems facing the Everglades as a whole. But a lot of times what's taking the brunt of that is the pythons. So it's sort of not worked in our favor, but as from a conservation standpoint, maybe it's done some good for the Everglades. But, you know, it's sort of there's a lot of politics behind it beyond just, you know, the snakes are there, the snakes are a problem. But, yeah, they definitely are a problem. They definitely are causing damage.
Right, but I mean, look, as an environmentalist, you have to be able to tell somebody from your educated standpoint, okay, and you study this stuff, that the feral pigs, the feral cats, the feral dogs can't, a Burmese python cannot compete with an ectothermic, you know, with a predator, a daily predator that sometimes seems to kill for fun, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely, like I said, there is a litany of problems facing South Florida. The Burmese pythons being just one of the many. But yeah, there's no positive solution for anyone. You know, the environment not benefiting from it. The snakes aren't benefiting from it. We as a community aren't benefiting from it. You know, there's no upside to the whole thing, you know?
Yeah, I can see that. I just don't understand why they can't just, you know, give us all the problems. Don't just tell us that the berms are the only problem, which is sometimes how they make it sound. So that bothers me a little. Have you been there, you've stumbled on a berm in the wild. What's that? That's got to be like, I mean, have you seen berms reproducing there? I mean, what evidence do you have that this is a, you know, as big or as close to as big a problem as they're making it sound?
So we've come across quite a few berms, especially if you go in like July or September, you see a lot of, or July and August, you see a lot of babies starting to crawl around. So there definitely is reproductive activity. We were actually really lucky enough to come across, well, we didn't come across it. They knew about it being there for about a month prior to me getting there. But they had this female berm that was incubating this cluster of eggs way deep in this concrete culvert. And so I was able to be there when the eggs hatched out, and we basically had to fish out all the babies, all the eggs, all the mom to get this data on this clutch. And, you know, she's probably about 25 feet back in this concrete culvert, and it's the impossible, too small for a person to climb down. So we had like snake tongs and snake hooks on 30-foot pieces of conduit that were kind of like fishing around in here. So, you know, it's quite the experience. But, yeah, it was very surreal to see this Burmese python laying on a clutch of eggs and see these eggs hatching out in South Florida, in the Everglades National Park. I mean, there's definitely reproductive activity occurring. There's definitely a population that is breeding down there, which was really surreal. And again, I've in the past have really downplayed that, and I sort of had to eat my words when I was like, okay, yeah, this is happening. This definitely is a problem to some extent.
Well, Steve, I can't even believe this, but I let it slip past the 2-minute warning, and now we got like a 20-second warning. Dude, I really appreciate you having you on. I definitely encourage you to post some of those pics, vids, or any other information you have from your trip on the boards. And once again, thanks on behalf of everybody for coming on and doing a great couple of shows. And I look forward to seeing you, hopefully, at Tinley.
Absolutely. Take care.
All right. Take care, man. Have a good one. Bye-bye.
Bye.